All right, it's Friday again, time for another movie retrospective, and here's one I've been wanting to do for a really, 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 really long time, and we're finally getting around to doing it.
Yep.
This is 1973's The Wicker Man.
Not the new one.
Not the new one, you guys.
Yeah.
I have not been able to bring myself. I've seen all the clips of it. You know, but I haven't been able to, like, bring myself to watch it.
I watched it. It was bad.
Yeah.
It was bad. Yeah, it ruined what the original one was about.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The original one had a message, and it really wasn't carried over. They just kind of, in the new one, they made it kind of like a cheesy horror flick that didn't make a whole lot of sense compared to the old one, if you knew what the old one was about.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk a little bit about analysis of this story and what it meant. You know,
yeah.
And towards the end,
it's interesting because it almost seemed like there was some kind of curse against this movie. Like for a really long time, it was like a really tortured like production. How it kind of came about was, you know, Christopher Lee obviously was very famous for doing Hammer movies, playing Dracula and things like that. And he kind of wanted to get out of that because he was afraid he was getting typecast. So he started talking to the screenwriter of this. His last name is Schaefer. I can't remember what his first name was. And also the director, Robin Hardy. Now, I think this was Robin Hardy's first movie. Before that, he was a playwright and he'd done like some theater productions and stuff. So they decided, they had this idea where like, we want to do something about like old time, like folk religion, like old pagan religions, because that was something that didn't get put in a lot of horror type movies. Although he doesn't really, I mean, Christopher Lee is
kind of... He didn't really consider it a horror movie.
It's kind of more a thriller, I guess you would call it, like a mystery.
Now, this movie here, it influenced a lot of people, actually kind of like in some of the early goth scenes.
Yeah.
Like Death in June and, actually it's like guys for like David Tibet and Douglas Spears.
Nature and Organization covered one of the songs in this.
Right.
And a lot of bands have covered
songs
from this.
In the early proto kind of goth scene, there was kind of a weird merger of kind of like Celtic mythology, folklore... And when you're talking about Douglas Pierce, kind of like German rune magic, where it was all kind of, they were kind of rejecting in a certain way the Christian establishment and kind of embracing the old ways of Europe, you know. And this movie kind of, I think, spurred on a lot of young people to kind of study these kinds of religions and try to understand what they meant and how they correlated to today, to the modern era.
Yeah.
It's an interesting period.
It's considered sort of one of the, you know, there was kind of a couple years in there where there were a couple of what they call British folk horror movies.
Yeah.
The other ones that are named are usually Witchfinder General, which came out in 1968, and also Blood on Satan's Claw, which came out in 1971, which actually I really like a lot. I like Witchfinder General too, but Blood on Satan's Claw, I wrote like a big long thing about it on my blog because I really like that movie and I feel like it's underappreciated. But so Christopher Lee and the screenwriter and the director wanted to do something about pagan religion in Scotland or somewhere in the UK. So there was this novel written by a guy, I think his name is David Penner, and it came out in 1967, 1968. It was called The Ritual. And it had a similar story to what ended up being The Wicker Man, but after the screenwriter read it, he's like, okay, well, I'm going to use the germ of this. You know, it still had to do with like a Christian going to this island and there was all these pagans and all this horrible shit happened, but he kind of like changed the story up a little bit. Interestingly, and I don't think you knew this, so you might find this interesting. The title and the image of the Wicker Man, that actually came from the screenwriter, I believe, was reading Julius Caesar's account of the Gallic Wars. And there was like a sentence in there where he was talking about these villagers, like in parts of what is now France. And that's how they would get rid of their convicted criminals. They would construct like a wooden man, like a big one, and put a guy in there and set him on fire. So that's where that whole imagery came from. So that's not like specific to the part of Scotland where the movie takes place. But I just thought that was interesting that it just came from, it came from Julius Caesar. That's where that, and because that image is so iconic, I think that's like the best known part of this movie, which I feel like got a little bit forgotten. It didn't really start getting a cult following until the 80s. And you know what's weird is that even though nowadays it's considered one of the best British horror movies ever made, for a time it didn't even really get a general release in the UK. What ended up happening was like I said, the production was really troubled. Christopher Lee and a lot of the cast and crew were really excited to work on it. They thought it was a great script, which it is. And so a lot of them worked for very little or no money. The story was supposed to be set in spring, but they had to film it in October. So they were all freezing their asses off. Although you can't really tell in the movie, they had to have like plastic trees and plastic flowers and stuff because everything was like barren and dead because they filmed it way up in Scotland and it was really cold. Shit like that. But then when the film was done, I think British Lion Productions was like the production company that had made it. It had been bought out by EMI. So EMI executives came to see the cut of it and were like, yeah, we don't like that.
They didn't like
it. They're like, you have to take, they told him to take like 20 minutes out. They also told Robin Hardy to change the ending to make it like a happier ending. They're like, well, shouldn't the guy get saved or shouldn't it come and rain and put the fire out or whatever? And Robin was like, no, we're not doing that. So he stuck to his guns on that. He did make some cuts to it. And so began this whole saga of like, there's so many versions. Like I've seen online that either the original cut was as much as 2 hours long or it was 102 minutes. But then they made, for the UK release, they made them cut it down to 87 minutes. They didn't take out anything because it's not gory or anything like that, but they just took out like a bunch of character scenes and stuff like that. It was nothing that was...
This movie is a slow burner. It has a very slow build-up.
Like and I said, it's more a mystery.
It's not really structured like a horror movie.
No, not at all.
It's not a horror movie, really. So you really have to stick with this one. It almost kind of feels like a documentary and a police investigation movie all kind of happening at the same time.
And a musical, sort of.
And showing you folklore, you know?
Yeah.
It does have a backstory. It does have was an overarching theme to it. And once you get to the end and you think about it, you know, which I'll probably talk about it later. Once you start thinking about the meaning of the movie, you go, oh, okay, I see what they're telling me. And I really didn't catch... the meaning of it until I saw a guy's analysis of it, which I was like, oh, of course, that's what it means. Yeah. And then I was able to kind of see some more than more to it than even what he saw. He's just a young guy. But there's like really only one analysis I've seen on YouTube. Yeah,
well, I've read a lot of different analyses of this movie. You know, not a lot of ones on video.
Several different cuts of this movie. Now, there's an interview with Christopher Lee, and he said that, you know, he's made almost 300 movies, like 275 movies, and he said that out of all of them, this one was his favorite, and he considered it to be a masterpiece. But the commonly viewed edit is not his, not the real edit.
Yeah.
All right? That wasn't his favorite one. That there was another edit that he liked a lot better. And he thought it was out there somewhere. And was hoping that it would emerge. And he thought somebody had that original cut. Well, it turns out somebody did have it. It was found in the possessions of, what's his name?
Roger Corman.
Roger Corman had it
because the production company sent him, it actually wasn't the entire cut. It was a 99-minute cut.
Okay.
And it got sent to Roger Corman because... they wanted him to try to distribute it, like for at drive-ins.
But it had
US
some of the missing stuff in it.
Yeah, it did.
Okay.
So he had it for a long time. I think he later gave it to like the Harvard Film Institute. I think was where they ended up finding it. But the interesting thing, like I said, it didn't really get a general release in the UK. Sometimes, like it got a couple theaters. It was usually like put on a double bill with Don't Look Now, which we really have to do a review of because that's one of my favorite movies in the 1970s. So it was kind of like the B picture to that. But interestingly, because it went to the US. And I think the 99-minute version was actually making the rounds in, you know, drive-ins and stuff. So it actually had a much bigger audience and a much bigger cult following in the U.S. than it did in its native country for a really long time. But over the years, like, its, you know, reputation grew. And then finally, like, it, you know, in the 80s, 90s, you know, the U.K. started getting, like, the more director's cut and stuff like that and sort of appreciated it more.
I don't think we've actually mentioned what this movie is about, if you guys have never seen this. It's about a British cop who gets a message or a lead on a missing persons case out from on this remote island. And when he gets to this island, he starts asking around if anybody had seen this girl. He's got a photograph of her, you know. And everyone's denying that this girl even exists when he gets there. And it's this quaint little village on an island, you know. And all the people there are kind of taunting and toying with him. And he turns out that they're not Christians, that they're some kind of a pre-Christian cult. And this cop is a devout Christian. And their ways are very different than his. Their culture and their belief structure is very different. You know, it's very much kind of like a free love type society, grounded in the earth. It's hippie, but not really. It's got kind of a dark side to it, you know. Very traditional seeming or traditional feeling kind of, you know, pre-Christian Europe type vibe going on there. Dressing up in costumes and having
green man, maypole.
Yeah,
all that
maypoles
kind of stuff.
And so he gets kind of wigged out on this. And it turns out that that girl never existed.
Yeah, she does.
Or she did exist, but she wasn't actually missing. And they had sent him this bum lead and this bum report of her disappearance because they were trying to lure him there because he was the perfect candidate for this sacrifice that they wanted to do to help bring the apples back.
Yeah.
And the way it ends, you know, everybody knows
everybody knows how it ends.
It's sticking in this big old wicker man and set him on fire. And he's praying to God and cursing them, you know, and they're all singing these happy folk songs while he's burning up. And when I first saw the movie, I thought it was just kind of that it had a striking end to it. But I thought it was just kind of at first kind of like a kind of a movie that kind of put pagan morality above Christian morality. But as time goes on, after I've heard a couple of other little, or that one guy's analysis, I see that there was a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, really. That is not the case.
That's not what it was about. It wasn't saying that paganism was better than Christianity. It was saying that Christianity was paganism.
That they were both equally
They were about the same thing. They were just different. It was about religious delusion.
Yeah,
that's really what it was about.
And an interesting thing that this movie did, one of the best things about this movie, like I said, the final like 20 minutes of it are like super horrific when Howie realizes that he's been played this entire time, you know, and he sees the Wicker Man for the first time and he realizes what's going to happen. And it's just this horrifying image. And like, you know, when the head falls off at the end and the sun is behind it and everything. But I think one of the coolest things about this movie is that from the beginning, Sergeant Howie's character, he's played by Edward Woodward, who up until then, he was actually a famous TV actor in the UK, and then he became a very famous TV actor in the US later on because he was on The Equalizer in the 80s. But he plays Sergeant Howie as a really unsympathetic character. This is one of the things that I think makes the movie work so well, because he's so stick-in-the-mud, he's so uptight. He doesn't have a sense of humor. He comes to this island and essentially starts throwing his weight around. You know what I mean? Because he's from the law and he's like, what do you can't have this pub open. You can't have this. You can't have. He's a virgin. He's like really. So
yeah, he's never
not
been married. So he's never had sex.
Yeah. So this is the character. This is the protagonist that you're seeing, you know, the whole entire story through. And initially when he first comes to Summer Isle and he meets Christopher Lee playing Lord Summer Isle and he meets all the locals, they seem, initially, they're kind of playful because everyone's like, Rowan Morrison, who's that? There's no missing girl. I don't know what you're talking about. And they seem playful. They seem happy. They seem joyous. They seem a lot more sympathetic than him.
Yeah, they're also very kind of animalistic. They just kind of have sex out.
Yeah, just outdoors. They're all naked, jumping over fire and stuff like that.
And like, you know, the best looking girl in town screws all the guys.
Yeah.
You know, and she, you know, doesn't charge them or anything, just screws them all.
Well, you know.
So, you know. And then they sing songs about it.
Yeah.
That she's a hoe, you know. It's funny, you know.
And she's like, that's right, I am.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But
so, like I said, in some ways, because Howie is so repressed, you initially find yourself sympathizing with the pagans at first, but then this is like a trap, much like the one that has been set for Howie, because as the movie goes on, it gets more and more sinister until you finally realize I've been sympathizing with the villains the whole time. Even as unsympathetic as Howie's character is, he ends up being the victim.
Yeah.
And even though, I've seen some reviews saying, so even though he was right, well, maybe he's morally right because he doesn't believe in human sacrifice. But as far as their religious beliefs go, neither one of them are right.
Yeah, there's a bunch of delusion going on, a bunch of moralistic delusion about really the only, what you can break the movie down in is that what was true was, is before they're getting ready to sacrifice him, he says, killing me isn't going to bring your apple crop back.
Yeah.
Because the reason why the apple crops failed is because the guy who established this island brought fruit from outside this temperate zone, you know what I mean, and tried to get it to grow in a place where it can't grow reliably.
And it worked for a while.
So your crops are going to fail sometimes. Killing me will not bring the crops back. So then they stick him in there and put him on fire, and he starts praying to God to be reborn, and, you know, he's preaching, which kind of is showing that there was another delusion. He believes that he's going to be reborn after death.
Because
he believes in this religion.
Right.
And he believes that in the same way that those people who are killing him believe that the crops will be reborn with his
sacrifice.
With his death. So basically what it meant, the deeper meaning is that, yeah, the crops will come back, but it won't have anything to do with this pagan religion. They'll just come back on their own.
Yeah, because that's how she
and
works.
Yeah, maybe after this guy dies, he might be in some kind of afterlife. But it doesn't have anything to do with his religion.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's really what it says. It says these religions are delusions.
Yeah, I think the end of it pretty fairly shows that it's like, you know, yes, it's horrible what they were doing to him, but he's not right either.
Yeah.
I mean, his belief isn't right either.
Right. If he comes back, or if he is reborn into an afterlife, it won't have anything to do with his religion.
Yeah.
You know, if those crops are reborn, it won't have anything to do with their religion. That's what they're talking about.
Yeah, it's just, it's kind of showing like...
that nature's running this, not them.
Yeah, that it's like you're trying to impose your will on something upon whose, you know, you can't impose your will upon it because it's like much larger than you.
Yeah, and it did kind of say that the... that the islanders, their pagan system did kind of allow them to live in kind of a more natural state.
Yeah.
But they were also deluded.
Sure.
You know what I mean? They weren't bringing crops back through human sacrifice. So,
yeah.
You know, and it also is kind of saying in a way that, you know, when you're talking about, you know, the crucifixion scenes and Catholicism and the way that it's set up, it's basically saying that Catholicism is just another form of pagan religion.
Yeah, well,
that's
which it is, because they took a
is.
Lot of stuff from
it.
They
took a lot of stuff from it. So the movie's really kind of saying that, you know, there isn't much difference between the two. They're both a delusion. That's what it's saying.
Well, and like I said, you know, aside from that, which, like I said, you don't even really need to pick up on that to, like, enjoy the movie, because really it's kind of like I said, I wouldn't call it a pure horror movie. It's more of like a mystery thriller type thing, or police procedural, because
with
this whole time.
With a philosophy behind it.
It's like the whole time Howie is trying to figure out what's going on with this missing girl, because he knows, like, what are all these weirdos? They're hiding something. Because at first they're saying, Rowan, you know, what are you talking about? There's no one here by that name. But then when he finds out that she does exist, and then he starts, oh, well, maybe she's dead, maybe this, that, and the other thing, and then he thinks that she's going to be the sacrifice, but then, like I said, at the end, he finds out that he's been manipulated the whole time, and there's some just really great imagery in this, like this, there's this one point where he's in the school classroom, and he opened up Rowan's desk, and inside the desk, there's like a nail, and there's like a beetle, and it's tied to a string, and the beetle's like walking around the string.
Yeah, getting tight.
You know what I mean?
And
he's just tightening and tightening, just like the plot is tightening around him. Mm. You know, kind of that's going to be his doom at the end. And he's just been led along this path the whole entire time because they have, you know, they figured they really need a big sacrifice because, you know, their crops have been bountiful up until now, but then it failed this one particular year. So they needed the big guns. They needed a really big, good sacrifice. So they determined that he was like the best one because he met all this criteria. So they just engineered this huge plot to get him there.
And then, you know, you're told a backstory by the character Christopher Lee plays. What was his name?
Lord Summerisle.
Lord Summerisle. That's right.
Yeah, well, because that's the name
of the
island.
That's the name of the island. His grandfather set all this up, and he kind of purged it of Christian thinking and kind of brought back kind of pagan beliefs and bred a bunch of plants that could grow there so the island could be self-sufficient. So they're growing apples and, I guess, fruit on an island where it shouldn't be growing, you know, and you kind of freed them from their, you know, restrictive Christianity. So that's why all this stuff is there.
Yeah.
It's not happening in a vacuum. And it wasn't some kind of holdover from the medieval period. It had only been doing this for a few generations.
Yeah. I think, it had been three generations because it was Lord Summerisle's grandfather that did it. Man, the kitty's being very noisy today.
And they didn't really have much contact with the outside world. They controlled who came.
Yeah. So, and the interesting thing, too, is that...
It was private property, you know, I guess.
Yeah. So. Well, yeah, because it was owned by Lord Summerisle's family. Yeah, that was his, like, fiefdom or whatever.
Right.
But the interesting thing, too, is that one of the things that Sergeant Howie says to Lord Summerisle is that, oh, you brought all these, you know, genetically altered, essentially, fruits, and you know, to make them grow where they're not supposed to grow, and it's against nature. But in some ways, Sergeant Howie, the way he is against nature, too, because he's very repressed. He's engaged to a girl, but they haven't had sex. He's, like, 40. Yeah. I think the actor was 42 in the movie.
42-year-old virgin. Yeah,
42-year-old virgin, which, not too many of those. But that's also against nature, kind of.
According to their religion, the sacrifice had to be act like a king, he had to be a fool, and he had to be a virgin and pure of heart and all kinds of
And
stuff
a fool,
like that.
Because he ended up... They engineered it so that he would end up dressed as Punch.
And, and as they're burning him up, they're kind of making sure that he's dying the death of a Christian martyr. Stuff like that. Which that kind of played in with it, too. So it's just...
It's a great movie.
Most people would say that this movie was probably a masterpiece of what it was trying to do.
Yeah. It's really good because the whole thing is... The way the whole thing is shot, it's pretty much all shot in the daytime, like in this really bright, flat, like almost documentary style.
Yeah.
Which actually sort of makes it unsettling because if you've never seen it before and like you're not...
Stop doing it. She's tearing the place apart.
Yeah, because you're not entirely sure, like, what's going on and, like, what's up with this missing girl and everything. And then the tension just gets tighter and tighter and tighter until this just, like, completely horrific ending. And it's unusual in that they didn't usually end movies that way, in the sense, you know what I mean? It would be like the EMI executive saying, you know, well, shouldn't somebody come and save him or shouldn't something happen, you know, so that doesn't... so the ending doesn't end the way it ends, but they were like, no, they didn't pull back. That's the way it ends.
They didn't want to wreck the meaning of the movie. Then the credits roll.
Yeah.
Like the Nicolas Cage one did wreck the meaning of the movie.
Although he died at the end of that one too.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, but they didn't really have the whole religious delusion.
It doesn't work the same because I feel like the Nicolas Cage one was transplanted to like some island off Washington State. They made the society like matriarchal, comparing
they made
it
man versus woman.
Well, compared, so it was like bees, so the men were drones and that kind of, so they had that whole thing going on, but they didn't have, I don't know, there's just something, it doesn't work the same because we don't have the tradition of like this Celtic or pagan, you know, religions of old Europe. We don't really have an equivalent of that that's kind of plays the same. So I don't think it really worked out. I think in the remake, they made it like this matriarchal society. They were all like, they were in Salem and they were persecuted for being witches or something. So they ran off to this island. So I think there was some explanation for that. But it doesn't work the same. And plus, if you've seen the original, I mean, the story is pretty much the same. So you know what's going to happen. So it's not a sense of, you know, a mystery or anything because you already know that Nicolas Cage got brought to the island because they were going to sacrifice him. So there's no surprise there. There's no suspense there. And it's just, it seemed like the whole thing was dumb. Now, an interesting thing is that there have actually been a couple of attempts to do like a sequel to the original Wicker Man. I think Robin Hardy the original screenwriter Schaefer, he wrote a script called something about the Lambton Worm, which is another kind of Scottish folk legend. And it was going to be, he wrote a script for it, and it was going to be like more of a fantasy type thing. But that never got made. I guess a lot of people didn't like it. And I think that script was supposed to hinge on the fact that Sergeant Howie did survive the Wicker Man, which the director was like, I don't like that. He was supposed to die at the end. You know, that's just how it works. And we're not doing a thing where,
they show him alive. They pretty much show him dying. I don't see how he could escape that.
That's what I mean. So it just seemed very like, I thought of that line from Misery. He didn't get out of the cock a duty car. Yeah. You know what I mean? So that kind of thing happened. Now, they did actually make a sequel I think, or a spiritual sequel, they call it. I think it was in 2011. It was the same director, Robin Hardy. Christopher Lee had a cameo in it. It was called The Willow Tree. It was actually, I think it was still...
Willow Tree or Wicker Tree?
The Wicker Tree, sorry.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I was thinking of something else. The Wicker Tree. And I was thinking of Willow, the character that Britt Eklund plays in the original movie. But, but yeah, so it's kind of, it's set in like a pagan Scottish village, same kind of deal. But this time it's like two American, like, evangelists that come there with their purity rings and all this other kind of stuff to, like, convert the heathens, and things go predictably from there. I haven't seen it, but I've heard it's really, really not very good. Although, in light of the 2006 Nicolas Cage remake, I'm sure it probably looks a lot better. It couldn't be any worse than that.
Him just running around punching people.
In a bear suit. I laughed so hard when I saw that the first time.
It just wasn't. They never should have remade the movie.
No, that's what I mean. It's just, it was such a product of its time, and also a product of its culture, that I just don't think you can transplant. It just doesn't translate to an American.
You try to take that Wicker Man story and update it for a modern American audience. It's just not going to work, because the Wicker Man is kind of a slow, kind of chilled out movie. It's not really interesting. By today's standards, you have to get about halfway through it before you start kind of get pulled into it. It does have its own its tone, its ambience. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it has a weird vibe.
It's
to
not
it.
Modern, not yeah. a modern movie.
It's a strange movie.
Yeah, it's weird.
And I feel like, and I read this somewhere.
It's hard to put it in time. There's nothing. It's a set made in the 70s, but there's nothing about it that lets you know that it's a 70s movie. It's just. It's almost kind of like an art movie in a way.
Yeah.
Like a... The only thing I can kind of compare it to in terms of tone would be Zardoz in a certain way. Just not as bizarre, but flying head. Zardoz was kind of
weird.
Zardoz was kind of free-flowing. It was like they were making it up as they were going along.
I think they were. Plus drugs.
Yeah, and... Wicker Man feels like they're making it up as they're going along, but they're not.
But it actually makes sense.
And towards the end, you go, hey, they're not really making this up.
Yeah.
Because they show you a bunch of scenes that you're not really sure why they showed you that. Then later...
But everything is there for a purpose.
Everything's there for
a
reason.
Like I said, because everything was engineered from the beginning.
Yeah.
So when you go back and watch it again, you're like, oh, okay, that's what they're doing.
Yeah, it doesn't explicitly tell you what these things mean.
Yeah.
That they're showing you. You just got to wait.
But yeah, so like I said, I feel sad for you if all you've seen is the Nicolas Cage remake, because you really need to go back and watch the first one. Because the interesting thing, and I was reading a review today where somebody said, you know, the Wicker Man almost seemed to come out of a vacuum. It's like it wasn't like inspired by any movie before it, really. You know what I mean? Because you kind of get a thing where there's horror movies and there's like, you know, certain kind of runs in horror movies. Like, oh, we're going to do vampire ones. But there wasn't really anything before that. I guess Blood on Satan's Claw, but that was set back in the Middle Ages.
It's because of what they were trying to do. This was more like a work of philosophy.
Yeah.
It's really what they're doing.
That's true.
So, although, you know, I'm looking at it today, I don't know if it's incredibly deep. It's just weird.
It is a weird movie. And like I said, if you like this type of folk horror, I would also recommend, like I said, Blood on Satan's Claw or Witchfinder General if you haven't seen it. I would also recommend the book Harvest Home by Thomas Tryon. He also wrote The Other from 1972. That was really good. Harvest Home, they made it into like a TV miniseries and it's not good. But the book is excellent. Like the book is, it's set in the United States, but it's a very similar this isolated town, and they're all sort of pagan-y, and they have like all these weird corn things.
In the context of 1973, I think it would have had a little bit of different impact, because there were a lot of hippie kids that were getting into all this kind of Wicca and crap like that. And this would have been interesting to them. They would have, oh, wow, this is neat. But then in the end, the movie tells them that, no, your shit's a delusion, too.
Yeah, it's like you're no better.
Yeah, so I think it would have had a different impact back then. I think it was a little bit more culturally relevant. You don't have a bunch of little cults and kids, you know, joining hippie cults and hippie communes and crap, you know. That just doesn't really happen like it used to.
Yeah.
So I think the audiences of those days would have been more intrigued or more interested in this.
Yeah,
I think an audience of today would, in general, be alienated by this. it's not showing a life that they know. There's no technology in it or anything, no social media.
Yeah. You know, well, I mean, I don't know, though, because
it's retro. It's like showing an Amish community, but it's just a bunch of, you know.
Yeah, but sometimes that's where the best horror comes from, is it, like, is this kind of culture clash between, you know, what you think is the normal world, and then suddenly you're transported back in time, and all these people, like, live in this totally bizarre.
That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I don't know. Young audiences today, they probably don't have the patience to sit and even watch this movie.
Maybe not. Although I have seen a lot of, like, younger critics that seem to like it, you know, so I don't know.
If they're into movies, if they're into film, and they're into philosophy, they would.
Yeah, because, like I said, it's more an art film, police procedural mystery type thing with kind of a horrific ending, rather than, like, a traditional horror movie, I guess. But it's actually one of my favorite movies in the 1970s, along with, like I said, Don't Look Now, which it often got paired with when it was at movie theaters. So we're going to have to do that one, too. Also, before we go, I want to add, and I only just found out this when I was researching this show, is that the infamous, well, I guess, don't guess it's infamous, but the famous British theme park, Alton Towers, has a roller coaster based on the Wicker Man. It has, like, a big Wicker Man that's on fire, and the fucking roller coaster goes through it. So if any of you guys have been on it, tell me if it's any good, because that sounds awesome. That's awesome, though, that I love that they made a roller coaster based on the end of that movie. That is fucked up and glorious. All right, so that'll do it for our breakdown of The Wicker Man from 1973. Check it out if you haven't already, even though we've just spoiled it. But like I said, everybody knows how it ends. Come on. And remember, if you like the show, to like, share, subscribe, and all your social media. If you'd like to financially support the show, you can go to our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/13oclockpodcast, or you can go to our blog, which is 13oclockpodcast.wordpress.com, and there's a link in the sidebar to a PayPal account if you'd like to give a one-time donation. Remember that our movie retrospectives come out every Friday, our 13 o'clock matinee, 3 new movies in the theater, that comes out every Sunday, and our regular episodes come out every Tuesday, so check them out. We will see you next time. Bye.